The subject matter is redigging old wells. One of the things that happened a lot back in the Old Testament is that when someone would go somewhere to settle down, they obviously needed certain things, especially if they had herds and whatever the case was, a lot of people, because most generally they moved as a family. And as time went on, the family would resemble more of a small tribe, clan, or something like that because of the sheer number of people. But water was something that was necessary. So they would dig a well somewhere. If they couldn't dig a well, if they couldn't find one that was adequate, they'd relocate somewhere else. But that was something that was very necessary. In Genesis chapter 26, there's Abraham. Now, Abraham was a herdsman, had been a herdsman, and he'd been very successful at it. And his son Isaac was also a herdsman. Now, being a herdsman was something that was necessary. It provided food and other things. But this was also what determined an individual's success, and especially their wealth. Now, if you'll notice in the Old Testament, when it talks about wealthy people, it will list a whole lot of things that contributed to their being wealthy. And you don't always find the same things, plural, with everyone, but you will find mention of someone that's wealthy as having a lot of cattle or sheep, flocks, whatever the case might be. And that was the case with Abraham. Isaac was a successful herdsman, and Isaac's success was such that it caused envy among the Philistines. If you look at Genesis chapter 26, verse 14, he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household so that the Philistines envied him. So he had about everything that was necessary to be recognized as a powerful man in those days. Now, the Philistines tried to thwart Isaac by filling in the wells that his father Abraham had established. In verse 15, all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them with earth. And they thought that would pretty well take care of it. But Isaac finally returned to the fertile valley of Gerar and set about redigging the old wells. Verse 18, that Isaac dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham, and he gave them the same names which his father had given them. So he was redigging old wells. And some of the wells that existed, even back in these days, there's Jacob's well. You read about that in New Testament times. And that's where Jesus met the Samaritan woman. And there's a well in Israel that is said to be Jacob's well, the original thing, the real McCoy. And archaeologists have examined this for a number of years, and well, they're not really sure if that is it in particular, but there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it very well may be. They can't prove that it's not. And if so, this is even an active well to this very day. So that means this is a well that's existed for a long, long period of time. And so a well that was dug by Abraham, filled in, it could be dug again, and it would still produce the water. If it could do it over a long period of time, of course, it could do it over a short period of time. But you think about him redigging old wells. Now, what I want us to do is to realize that there's a principle involved here of redigging old wells. It's not anything that's new. Sometimes it's necessary to go over things that have been around for a while. And one of the works of a preacher that you find over in the letters that were written to preachers in 2 Timothy chapter 2, I guess of all the letters that are written to preachers, 1st, 2nd Timothy, and Titus. 2nd Timothy has always been something that I've liked a whole lot. And in chapter 2 and verse 14, talks about one of the works of a preacher is to remind them of these things and solemnly charge them in the presence of God not to wrangle about words, which is useless and leads to the ruin of the hearers. Charge them. Several times in these letters that are written to young preachers, why the word charge them is used a number of times, and that means something that's solemn, and it's a duty that needs to be performed. Well, it's to remind them. Now, Peter also makes mention of this business of remembering truths already known. In 2 Peter chapter 1 and verses 12 through 15, 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 12 through 15, therefore, I will always be ready to remind you of these things, even though you already know them and have been established in the truth which is present with you. I consider it right, as long as I am in this earthly dwelling, to stir you up by way of reminder, knowing that the laying aside of my earthly dwelling is imminent, as also our Lord Jesus Christ has made clear to me. And I will also be diligent that at any time after my departure, you will be able to call these things to mind. Well, you call these things to mind because you've been reminded of them. Chapter 3 and verse 1. This is now, beloved, the second letter I am writing to you, in which I am stirring up your sincere mind by way of reminder. I think it's just a principle that you repeat things in order that others will learn the things that are repeated. We learn lots of things by repetition. I dare say that everybody here, if you can think back that far and remember the occasion, learned your multiplication tables on the basis of repetition. You went over them and over them again. Some people might not have gone over them very many times. Others, perhaps, a number of times, and even then to no avail. But I can remember going over those things, and I was whizzing along till I got, you know, like the eights and the nines, and those presented just a little bit of a problem, and for some reason, they were harder than all the others. But I know this. I didn't know anybody in our class that went over them one time and had them aced. That just didn't happen. That would be extremely unusual. No, you went over them again and again. And it works that way all through the things that you learn. You go over this, and we learn by the repetition. And we're told these things in repetition so it'll sink in, so it'll settle in. And so we'll become accustomed to whatever it is that we're hearing over and over again. And yes, sometimes this needs to be done whenever you're raising children. You have to oftentimes tell them things over and over again. I know with my children, I could tell them something one day that they were either to do this or not to do that. I'm telling you, when the sun would come up the next day, in their mind, it's a brand new day, and everything Dad said yesterday, just forget it. And we went over this stuff, I don't know how many times, till they finally realized, I'm going to keep telling you this until I don't have to tell you anymore, that you'll finally have it in there. Works the same way, I guess, somewhat with husbands and wives. I won't say which direction that's going, but, you know, you repeat things, you know, over and over to get the point across, to get it in there. So this is something that needs to be done. And I think it's a tool of Bible teaching as well. And we think to ourselves, oh, yeah, that's something that new converts, you know, they need to be reminded of things, and things need to be repeated to them over and over again. Well, it's not just for new converts. I think it's for all of us to go over these things. So in a sense, this is like redigging old wells. Yes, I've heard that. But you know what? You need to hear it again. I remember when I moved to West Virginia, there was a man there who told me, he said, you know, we've heard lots of lessons on institutionalism, what the church ought to do with its money and what they shouldn't do with the money. We've heard lots of lessons on that, he said. And we've pretty well got that down. We pretty well have that, you know, figured out. I said, okay. I wasn't saying that they did. I was just, you know, I didn't have anything else to go on. I had to take his word up to a point. And so we went over other things, but we went over those things on institutionalism as well. Interesting fact, the man who told me that they had this cold is now worshiping at an institutional church. I wonder to myself, how well did you have this down now? I've thought of that a lot of times. And perhaps he needed a little bit of a refresher from time to time, more so than what he may have assumed. But I'd like for us for tonight to just go over and redig a few old wells in our time to spend together. First one I'd like for us to consider, and this is a good one, it's a good one to start with, that we can know the truth. Now, John chapter 8, verse 32, that's what Jesus has to say. And now, this is something he says, you can know the truth and the truth will set you free. The truth will make you free, depending on the translation you have. Now, right off the bat, that's something different from what most of the religious world would have to say. A lot of folks in the religious world don't think that you can know the truth. They don't even sometimes think that there's a truth. They're kind of like Pilate who asked, what is truth? As though there wasn't some kind of body of truth. But Jesus says that we can know the truth. And while some say there is no truth, and some say we cannot know the truth, well, now what are we going to do? Who do we believe in all this? Do we believe Jesus who said we can know the truth, or do we believe these others? We've got a choice to make here. Whom do we believe? Now, there are a number of New Testament passages that teach that we can know the truth. I'd like to look at some of those tonight. Now, there are others besides the ones that we're going to be looking at. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 4, Paul writes, by referring to this, now that is the things that he wrote, when you read the things he wrote, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ. You can know what I've written, and you can know the truth. What else do we find? Well, we go on to chapter 5 and verse 17, where it says, so then, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. We can understand the will of the Lord. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15, but in case I am delayed, I write so that you will know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God. Now notice this part, the pillar and support, or pillar and ground of the truth. You can't be the pillar and support of the truth if you can't recognize the truth. If you can't recognize the truth, you can't support anything, you can't hold anything up if you can't recognize it. Now that's just, you know, the basic principles of it. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 3, you talk about men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods, and they existed in Paul's day, which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and what? Know the truth. Well, even the Apostle Paul understood that you could know the truth. In 1 John chapter 2, John here writing toward the end of the New Testament and New Testament times of Revelation, says in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 21, I have not written to you because you do not know the truth, but because you do know it, and because no lies of the truth. They knew it then, we can know it now. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 6, we are from God. He who knows God listens to us. But he who is not from God does not listen to us. And by this, watch now, we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. So we know both of those. But the passages we're looking at here are telling us that we can know the truth. And there are others that would be telling us the same thing. Now that doesn't mean it's always going to be easy. We're talking Bible class this morning. I made a comment about how some people can say that they're reading the Bible, and they're actually reading the Bible. They're reading the New Testament, for example. Well, are they really reading it and understanding it? That's different. And while I didn't think of it in class to make the comment, I thought of it towards the end of the class. Do you remember the case where Philip met the eunuch? The eunuch had been up in Jerusalem. And he's on his way home back to Ethiopia. He's got a scroll. It says the book, but it's a scroll. It would have been a scroll of Isaiah in his hands. He's got it there. And he's reading from it. And it says he's reading from it. And when Philip gets close enough, he hears him reading from it. Well, you'd have a hard way to go to deny he's not reading this. But then he says things that show us he didn't have a clue as to who Isaiah was referring to, even though he was reading it. He didn't know. Because he says, who's the prophet speaking of? Is it the prophet himself? Is it some other man? Who is this? And then Philip gets up there and explains it to him as to who it is, that it's Jesus Christ. He begins to preach to him Jesus. But now, you know, when he asks the Ethiopian, do you understand what you're reading? He says, how can I except some man guide me? Now, there are some things where we might need a little bit of help and someone to assist us and to guide us. But to read it on your own and think that, well, there's parts in there, nothing in there that's difficult. Nothing in there that's difficult. It's all easy and everything. I suggest somebody take the time to read the book of Ezekiel sometime. I've never seen anything like it. There's stuff in there. I've not got a clue to this day as to what some of those things are all about. But they're in there. And they're in there for a reason. I think the people back in those days understood what it all meant. But boy, I'm telling you. Anyway, there are some things that are difficult. And you know what? In 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 16, Peter says that. He says, you know, Paul writes some things. Now listen, he says, which are hard to understand. He didn't say that they were impossible to understand or they couldn't be understood. He said they're hard to understand. And so you might have to, you know, look these things over, keep after it. Maybe you get a little help, something or another. But it's not still not impossible to know, even if it's difficult. So we can know the truth. That's the first thing. That's the redigging of the old wells. That's something that we need to be emphasizing with ourselves as well as others, to our children and whoever else we might come in contact with. Now, another old well that needs to be redug is that we must preach the whole truth. Acts chapter 20. Let's look over there for just a second. And verse 27. Acts chapter 20, verse 27. I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole purpose of God. Now there are some that will suggest to us that, well, we should accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. That sounds good. And I think that's a very good statement to make there. The problem is the statement doesn't exactly jive with what you find in the New Testament. Yes, there are a number of positive things that are found in the New Testament, but sometimes there are some negative things in the New Testament. And did you know that sometimes even the negative things in the New Testament have a positive spin to them? I see where Jesus told the woman that was brought to him, caught, it says, in the very act of adultery, says, go and sin no more. Is that a negative statement? Some might say it's a negative statement. Well, does it have a negative connotation? No. He's upbeat and positive about it. He thinks that she can actually go and sin no more. He'd get after the Pharisees. He'd get after first one, then the other. He got after his own disciples and sometimes said some negative things to them. You don't know what you're reading. You don't understand what you're reading. And you don't realize what you're saying. Sometimes he said things like that. Oh, how negative. Well, yeah. But again, he had the idea that with more teaching, calling your attention to these things now, you can have a positive result. You can know what you're reading. You can understand these things. So sometimes, you know, just because it appears at first to be negative, that's not the idea, you know. But so, yeah, you accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. No, that's not really it. I think there needs to be some balance in this. And then sometimes folks will come along and they'll say something like this, that we should connect more with young people and the unchurched. I think that's kind of a loaded question. Well, yeah, sure, we ought to connect more with young people and young church, but now, you know, what does that mean? Connect more on what level, on what line, and other things like that. That sometimes is a statement that sounds, you know, I don't know, sounds appropriate, but it's just kind of a nebulous statement. There's not really any substance to it as to figure out exactly what it means. Anyway, the Bible teaches the need to preach all of the truth. In Acts chapter 20, again, verse 20, I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable in teaching you publicly and from house to house. All the truth must be preached to be true faith. You can't hold anything back. All of it's got to be preached. Faith, we are told in Romans chapter 10, verse 17, aren't we, comes from hearing the Word of God. And so if faith comes from hearing the Word of God, then what do we need to do? We need to preach the Word of God. And again, in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, you find Paul here encouraging Timothy to do just exactly that, that you preach the Word and be ready in season and out of season. And you reprove and you rebuke. Well, that might be considered negative things, but no, not really all negative. But also you exhort with great patience and instruction. That's to be added in there. There should be some balance here. The time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and they will turn away their ears from the truth and will turn aside to myths. Now be warned about this. And you need to keep preaching the truth and encouraging people to do the right thing. And they need to hear all the truth, not just part of it. They need to hear the whole thing, the complete, unvarnished truth. Now, another thing, and I think this is kind of the next step you go to if you're, you know, following along this line, but another old well that needs to be redug is we must contend for the faith. Jude verse 3. Now, that doesn't mean to be contentious about the faith, but it means to contend for the faith. A lot of times there are folks that are kind of shy when it comes to confrontation. But now certainly the Apostle Paul wasn't one of those individuals. He says in Philippians chapter 1 verse 16 that he was set for the defense of the gospel, or appointed for the defense of the gospel. And the idea means, you know, I've come along for this particular time. That's why I'm here, for the defense of the gospel. It's almost like what was said by Mordecai to Esther. He said, who's to say that this wasn't all in the plan, that you were to be here at this point in time, holding this position, in these kinds of circumstances where you can go and get the king's ear? That's what he was saying there. And it seemed like Paul thought the same thing. You know, this is what I'm here for. Appointed for the defense of the gospel. If we won't defend the gospel, Christians won't defend the gospel, who will? Who will do that if we don't do this? In Philippians chapter 1 and in verse 27, he uses another word here. Now notice, only conduct yourselves in a manner, Philippians 1:27, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I will hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit and with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. He says we must strive for the gospel. Use that word strive there. Kind of like the word defend. You know, sometimes the idea of contending for the faith or striving for the gospel, people say, well, it sounds like, you know, you're kind of spoiling for a fight. No, not looking for one. But now if one comes along, I'm ready to defend the truth. I'm ready to advance the truth if that's what's necessary. Paul said he fought the good fight, but I don't think you can say Paul went out in different places looking for a scrap. They seemed like they always found him. And whenever anybody came along with that kind of a thing, he was ready for it. But we also need to remember, that's what it is. We're in a fight here. We talk about the devil being our foe. We talk about him walking around like a lion seeking whom he may devour. We talk about the weapons of our warfare. We talk about the armor of God. Put on the whole armor of God and all those kinds of things. And then some folks, after going through all of that and acknowledging all of that, and come down to it and say, well, you know, we shouldn't really be interested in a fight. Really? Then why all of this if that's not part of it? So that's one of the old wells that need to be redug. Now there's another one here I'd like for us to consider, and that is we must not be like the world. I think that one right there might be bigger sometimes than we think that it is. I think sometimes it's very easy to think to ourselves, I'm not like the world, and not realize that you are. You know, it's interesting sometimes to look at how things have happened over history. When I was in Arkansas, if we had one man, if we had different speakers, we had somebody come every night, Monday through Friday. But if we had one man come for a gospel meeting for some reason, Wednesday night, and he was done. And the elders there, there was a consensus among the elders. Well, you can't get people to come out on Thursday or Friday. Well, why is that? Well, because they've got the weekend in mind and they're getting ready for their weekend activities. And Friday night, they'll be heading out for the weekend. They're not interested in gospel meetings. So you're saying that the numbers will go down. Yeah, the numbers will go down. Will there not be anybody here? You know, I just ask that. Will there not be? Yeah, but there won't be very many. And I'm not going to argue about that. I mean, that would happen, sure. Sure. I think we recognize this. But then I think back to myself, how about back years ago when I'd read about a two-week gospel meeting? And on Sunday, maybe there would be three times of preaching on Sunday. And then I read about T.B. Larimore holding a meeting in Sherman, Texas that lasted for, I'd get 5 or 6 weeks. He preached twice a day, three times on Sunday. And people came. I forget how many people responded to the gospel in that particular gospel meeting. It's just incredible. But then you think about the number of sermons that were involved there. Now, people did it back then. Can't do it now. Three or four days. That's all we can tolerate. And I think the question then is to ask, who's winning here, the world or God? And if you just consider it from that angle, who's winning? Looks like the world's winning, doesn't it? And sometimes we might not think that. Oh, we're still having a gospel meeting. Well, yeah, we are, but you know, sometimes it's just on life supports. Oh, we're still having Wednesday night Bible studies. Sometimes it's just, well, that's on life supports too. What's happened? Well, maybe the world's winning. And maybe we don't realize it. It's just taking over things so slowly that we don't recognize it. You know the old thing. I don't know whether anybody's ever done this or not, but it's that old thing about the frog in the hot water. Everybody heard that? You know, you take a frog and you put him in a pan of water and you turn the fire on. And the water will slowly heat up and it'll just boil the frog to death. Just a little bit at a time, he stays in there. But if you take a frog and drop him in boiling water, he jumps right out. Now, which one's going to win over the frog here and defeat the frog? Well, just a little bit at a time does. And that's kind of how the world does this. And Satan's pretty well happy. Every brick that he gets, one at a time, that he can pile on to the whole load. And I think sometimes we don't recognize that. And you know, we live in the world. Sure we do. And we've got to defend against his influence. And it won't do us any good to go out there and stick our head in the sand someplace and say, oh, that's what we're really doing, whenever, well, we're not doing that at all. Now, there are some that want to come along here and they'll want to reinterpret some passages to accommodate worldliness. I understand that. I've heard that. Dealt with that. Some will criticize those who resist and reject worldly involvement. Well, they're just a bunch of old-fashioned stick-in-the-muds, mossbacks, whatever they want to call them, whatever it is. And not realizing, you know, well, what you're saying is then you should just give in and not defend. Is that it? And we'll modify it in some way where we can justify it, rationalize it better, and salve our conscience as we all just invite the world in and just let it come in. Now, Jesus warned a number of times against worldliness. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 22 is one of those times. He says, "The one on whom the seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word." Now watch now. "And the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of wealth choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful." Now we talk about it happening today. Well, it's happening in Jesus' time. What about Jesus warning, or excuse me, John warning against worldliness over there in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17? Don't we know those passages? "Love not the world." And what is the love of the world? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. Those are things that are of the world, not of the Father. And the world may be passing away, but the one who does the will of the Father will live forever. We understand those, but do we see the warning about this? And do we not only just see the warning, but do we heed the warning? And do we take advantage of the warning and avoid these things? Loving the world can just be, you know, disastrous. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, we see mention of this individual by the name of Demas, verse 10, where Paul says that Demas, having loved this present world, has departed me and gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Now, I don't know why Titus went to Dalmatia. I don't know why Crescens went to Galatia. But Demas left and departed to Thessalonica because he loved this present world. I do know that. And so I think we can see why this is a serious matter. We don't need to be like the world. Because if we're like the world, well, there can just be disaster at the end. There'll be no good thing come from being like the world. So one of the wells that we need to redig is that we must not be like the world. And I think that that's something that needs to be emphasized maybe more so every day. Also, we must be committed, our final point, we must be committed to the Word. We looked at several things there in Acts chapter 20. But at the end of the chapter, as Paul is taking leave from the elders at Miletus, Acts chapter 20, you find in verse 32 his parting words, some of his parting words. He says, "And now I commend you to God and to the word of his grace, which is able to build you up and to give you the inheritance among all those who are sanctified." I think to myself sometimes it must have been a wonderful thing that for 3 years, as Paul said, he was there with the church at Ephesus. What that would have been like to have had an apostle in your midst, and all the good that would have been done at that time, all the groundwork that could be laid, everything that could happen having him there for a period of 3, it would have just been terrific. Now here he was here back for a visit. There's no doubt that maybe there was one of these men, maybe more, that when they went to have this little interview with Paul, that they thought in the back of their mind, maybe we could talk him into staying with us for a while. Wouldn't that be great? Why, it'd be great, wouldn't it? Sure. And there wouldn't be anything harmful with that. And oh, the number of good, positive things that could happen if he'd stay with us. Because look what happened before. It'd be great, be wonderful. But Paul points them to something else that can build them up just as much as if he stayed there himself. And you see what it is. It's the word of his grace. That's what's able to build you up. That'll continue to build you up. "I'm leaving. I'm going off. You'll not see me again. But you'll have the word of his grace there. And that can build you up. And it did it then, and it can do it now. But we've got to be committed to that word. And such a commitment is going to safeguard those in the faith. Look at verses 29 and 30. I know that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock, and from among your own selves men will arise, speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after them. Yes, but now you know what? If you'll be committed to the word, you'll be able to handle this situation, and you'll be successful in resisting when those kinds of things come your way. And such a commitment like this, ultimately, will save those who believe it and those that they come in contact with. In Acts chapter 11 and verse 14, Cornelius heard in the vision by the Spirit that it's going to speak words to you by which you will be saved, you and all your household. If we're committed to the word, it'll safeguard those who are in the faith, and also it will save those who believe it. That's us. That's others we have contact with. Redigging old wells and scriptures are profitable endeavors, and we need to remind ourselves of those things lest we go by the wayside. I think sometimes it's easy to say, I've heard that before, I don't need to hear it again. Well, actually, you do need to hear it again. You start in Acts chapter 2 and read what the apostles had to say. And then you go to chapter 3 and see what their preaching was. Then you go to chapter 4 and 5, see what their preaching was. They didn't change a thing. Preached the same thing in Acts chapter 2, 3, 4, and 5. And there were people there who heard it again and again and again. And it didn't hurt them. Actually, it benefited them, because it implanted the word in their mind and in their heart so they could understand what they needed to do. And we have the same thing to do today. Well, turn your songbooks to the song that's been selected. Now is an opportunity, you know, at the end of a service, at least I try to do it all the time, is to end the service with an earnest entreaty for those who are not Christians to become a child of God. Believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, repent of your sins, be baptized. It's the old message, but it's the message that you find in the Scriptures. It's what's required to make one a child of God. And if you have a desire to comply with that tonight, keep in mind that, as the song says, He's able to deliver you. He's able to save you. If you have done these things, fallen by the wayside, need the prayers of the saints, we'd be happy to assist you, pray with you and for you. Whatever the case is, this is the right time, this is the right place. If you have a need, please come while together we stand and sing.